Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 16th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 8th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds from the event benefited Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event could not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners. First Lending Solutions, Housing Wire, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club for Women, MVT Productions, Property Radar, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, and White House Catering.
When I look at charts of promises that we've made, we have upcoming a chart that could go vertical if we don't have more revenue or we break promises. And so real estate is one of those investments that we really have a lot of goodies. There's no place else in the world where you can make $500,000 every 2 years tax-free. 1031 exchange, millions of dollars of assets, never pay taxes until it gets to be your estate and then turns to zero. So my question is, you know, we have all these goodies, including Prop 13. There's got to be an appetite to take a look at that box and say, can we have some of those goodies? Which ones probably are too sacred to touch, and which ones do you think could go by the wayside?
I can maybe take that. In California, I think the low-hanging fruit, at least this is the perception of the public employee unions who have an endless appetite for money, is that split roll property tax, where you tax commercial properties at a different level than residential. They're very much, very serious about potentially pursuing a November 2016 ballot measure that would enact a split roll, thereby bifurcating residential and commercial under Prop 13.
And that goes up in front of the vote of the people when?
Well, no, it's not
I'm
yet.
I'm only kidding.
But it could. I mean, we've been successful. One of the other hats I wear is I sit on the board of the California Business Properties Association, which are commercial industrial developers and real estate owners. And it's been something we've feared for years, but it's getting more. The drums are beating louder on the folks with the appetite for state money. And we do believe that, I mean, we've seen bills in the legislature that would amend the Constitution, amend Prop 13 to do this, but they can't be successful there because in the state legislature, you need a two-thirds vote in both houses of the legislature to pass a constitutional amendment and then put it on the ballot. So instead, we expect that if they're going to do it at all, they'll do it by initiative.
Okay. What about anything about 1031 exchanges? Is that anybody familiar with that? I think they were talking about limiting it to $1 million a year. I don't know who is, but again, that's just be aware that, you know, real estate has some goodies that could provide revenue, and some of it, you know, you could make a case for that. Yeah, that's pretty reasonable to have that discounted somewhat.
Well, it's interesting on the split roll, because if that really did happen, it'd probably be very beneficial to the residential market that's really been carrying the water, the commercial side, forever, because we don't have a split roll. And certainly my association, CAR, has always been opposed to a split roll. But it's kind of interesting if you just look at, you know, what... You know, what's happening there. I think the residential market would probably benefit.
How would it benefit? Because the taxes wouldn't change.
I think
change
one
for
of the things that's happening in the commercial is there's a lot of transfers that happen that don't get reassessed, right? Because they're using stock.
Okay.
Isn't that right? So
okay.
It's kind of skirting that issue.
See.
Is that part of the
That's been the argument
part of
in the
argument?
Capitol, but it hasn't won the day. I mean, I can't remember off the top of my head the statistics on that,
yeah.
but a lot of that is a fallacy that the California Taxpayers Association, the folks who want a tax, have continued to profligate, and it seems to be catching. But that part of the industry that I'm involved with does not think that residential has been getting a free ride based on the backs of commercial. residential or commercial. I'm sorry, vice versa.
Right.
The commercial
right.
has been
And we had a task force that looked at it in great detail last year and came to the conclusion that we need to continue to support support the current situation.
Okay.
What about the MID?
The realtors always go after that. My former employer, and when they talk about flat tax and all, I mean, that's
right.
it's like
and that's always the argument.
Stand up and get
I'd
it.
Certainly, anybody in the room be willing to give up your mortgage interest deduction for a flat tax at 24% all day
yes.
long, right? So it is a tax code problem. I mean, you're talking about 1031, it changes the MID, whatever it is. It's still an overall tax code structure problem,
right?
That could release all this cash back into the market, I'd give it up tomorrow. I mean, I've never qualified a borrower in all the applications I've taken over the years and sat down and said, first-time home buyers especially, who don't itemize anyway, well, you know your mortgage interest deduction is going to be, and it's going to lower your payment a little bit, and you can qualify for an extra $10,000. Nobody does that. Okay? It's the people, the high end, don't use it and don't need it. The low end, don't deduct for it, and it's that meat in the middle. It doesn't really make any difference. So that is something that should be thrown out there if you can get a lower tax rate or tax rate.
Okay, so we have some tradable. Now, Leslie, you haven't said a word here.
Well, I mean, with tax reforming, I mean, everything's on the table. And I think for 4 or 5 years, we've had a resolution going around Capitol Hill, and most of the California congressional delegation has signed it and essentially says, we support the MID, don't change it. But if anybody here remembers 1986, and it's like 11:30 at night, and all of a sudden these deals are cut, and voila, we have the $1 million cap on a residential mortgage for interest deduction. So I think anything's possible, but I do think, you know, I mean, you know, your points are well taken, and anecdotally, I'm sure they're true, but just doing the math, I mean, there is going to be losers when you get rid of the mortgage interest deduction. So how that trades off is interesting. I mean, some of the proposals that came out during the last presidential election weren't really targeted at MID, but they said we're going to cap all deductions at $50,000, $40,000, $30,000, whatever it might be. So it would be kind of an indirect take at that. So anything's possible, but it doesn't look like anything will happen until after the presidential election.
I think the bigger question is, what are your policy objectives for housing?
Right.
What are you trying to accomplish? So if what you're trying to accomplish, excuse me, is first-time home ownership, the mortgage interest deduction is a useless tool because the people at that income level don't itemize, so they don't deduct that. A first-time tax credit would actually be an incentive because it comes right off the amount of taxes that you paid. Of course, it wouldn't have the power that you think it would because people at that level don't actually pay that much taxes. About 96% of all the taxes are paid by people at the 50 percentile and above. So it's not as great a lever. Well, if you eliminated, I actually think if they're going to attack it, the first thing that will be done is the interest deduction on home equity loans will be eliminated, which is it's the interest on a maximum of $100,000.
Right.
I think that would be the first thing that would go. And then you may see an attempt to cap it at below $1 million, maybe at $500,000 or something like that. But what will happen if you eliminate it completely is because of what Dave said, it being a tool to get upper middle and upper middle income households to increase leverage and buy a bigger home, what will happen is people will consume less housing. Those house prices at the higher levels, not the very high level, because that's just a management issue, but at the upper middle income, those prices will fall, but prices at the low end will rise as people shift their consumption of housing down to smaller housing components.
Okay.
So there will be a redistribution of equity wealth in the housing market.
The concept of gentrification, where is it occurring? Sean, you and I had talked briefly about this.
Certainly in Silicon Valley right now.
So for people that don't know what it is, which honestly I was one of them for, I had to look it up because it isn't happening in Riverside yet. But so what is it and who's being displaced and who are they being replaced by?
But you know, in Silicon Valley, you've got, I mean, it's the world's greatest draw for tech talent. You're bringing in, you know, the smartest people from around the world, and they're coming in to compete for those homes, and they're pushing the prices of those homes up. And that's displacing, you know, folks that have lived there for generations. Their kids can't buy a home there. They have to go somewhere else. And, you know, it's also pushing up rents, and they can't afford to rent there. And, you know, so that is happening. I mean, it's...
Is that free market, though?
It's absolutely free market. I'm not... No judgment.
I know you're not. I'm trying to put it out there, not as a judgment thing. I'm saying, I guess I'm just making the point. That's free market. That's not a manipulation of holding interest rates down or minimum wage or whatever it is. It's the market working there, right?
Right.
Which is, I think, what we all want. So, I mean, it's bad for some, good for others, but... And then all of a sudden you want to come in and say, well, we can't have that, so we got to stop it. Why do you have to stop it?
Well, I think one of the issues is just workforce housing. And when, you know, firemen and policemen and teachers can't live near where they're working, it's not really very efficient. And that you can't have communities that accommodate diversity. You know, if only rich white people can live there, it's probably not going to be a very robust society. And for anyone that hasn't seen it yet, HBO has a very interesting documentary called San Francisco 2.0 that looks specifically at kind of the IT migration into San Francisco and what it's doing. And you're absolutely right. That's how market works. I mean, you've had gentrification. You know, I have a daughter in Brooklyn. I mean, you look at Brooklyn today, Brooklyn 20 years ago. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, but people are displaced, and there's a lot of pain, and it's just tough. You know, transitions are always tough. But I go back to the argument that workforce housing is absolutely critical for the health of a community, which is why if you don't have programs to kind of help with that adjustment, you just get people leaving and moving other places. And
can I play moderator for a second?
You bet. Go right
ahead. Okay, so here's the question. So HUD right now is talking about, they're doing it, holding funds back to communities unless you build certain types of housing within certain types of neighborhood. You can, they want rental housing and lower income housing with high, and they're trying to create neighborhoods. And if you don't do that, you're not going to get any funding. Is that?
And the only way you can force that is to put it on the back of a new home builder, if you have a new home builder.
Right, but I'm saying, I'm throwing it out as a question, and I'm not judging it in any way at all. I'm just saying, but that's not a free market, and that is the government taking our money and saying, you can't have it unless you do it our way. Okay, that's...
I think part of the question here, if we want housing to be more affordable, let's build more affordable housing, not put on, you know, net zero energy. I mean, I love the idea of net zero energy home. I wish my home was net zero energy. But if we're going to add that $50,000 of cost to every affordable home that gets built, and this is the what's so nuts about the conversation. It's like, if we, these are solvable problems, right? We're really good with technology and other things. And if we get these to be non-political problems and start figuring out, okay, how do you build something that's more affordable? Well, you know, start by, you know...
Less regulation.
I built a home, and, you know, the amount of... I was telling somebody earlier, you know, I'm up in Tahoe. I have to support a 100-year snow load and a 100-year earthquake at the same time. The cost of building that level of infrastructure is enormous compared to what's been standing for 100 years downtown. It just seems so common sense to me. If you want to build affordable housing, you know, we can make homes less affordable. A friend of mine moved from California to Washington. Rains more in Washington. Well, guess what? In California, you have to put bitumen and do all these things around a window, right, to put a window in. Up there, you just nail a window in, and if it leaks, you get some caulk. It's not that hard.
Right. Yeah.
Is there a connection for urbanization and gentrification. Anybody? And urbanization, what does that term? What does that term mean? We're going to live in like big cities now.
I think you and I talked about this, and I can tell that Bruce is a kind of a gated community kind of guy. Am I right? And I'm a walkability kind of girl.
Now,
I like living in a diverse environment where I can walk places, where I come into contact with people from all different everything that I'm not. And a lot of the millennials are like that. Now, I don't know if that will change when they have kids. And I did the gated community thing for 15 years, so I've been there, you know, and done that. But I think there's a whole new world out there of people that are looking at the trade-off between drive time and quality of life and saying, I'd really like to live near where I work, and I that trade-off is worth it. I think the other thing to think about, and there was a wonderful presentation at the LAEDC forecast for any of you that missed it from PricewaterhouseCoopers, who has a lot of resources around this issue of your footprint. So in terms of resources that you're consuming. And one of the numbers that really stuck with me, the dates, was July 14th. And July 14th is the date at which everything that we have consumed can be replenished. And then after July 14th, we are using resources that, you know, we're in a deficit. And if you're in a smaller house, you know, 1,000 square feet, you're using a lot fewer resources than you are if you're in a 4,000 square foot home. And we're seeing that in the office market with these companies where everybody's got a stand-up desk in the middle and conference rooms around. So I think this whole idea of how much space you need and how much time you're actually spending out of your home, I mean, it's just a very different aesthetic. So I think the wonderful thing about living where we live is you can do it all. But it's happening, right? Because they're valuing their time above that kind of a lifestyle, and they kind of like the energy of being in a higher density environment. And for anyone that hasn't like trekked to downtown LA lately, I mean, it's amazing what's going on there. Finally, you know, it's very exciting and vibrant. So,
and is that a free market dictating how?
I don't think there are any free markets anywhere.
I just agree, my personal thing. So I don't mean
to disagree with you. You know, if the benefits go, what you know, I
that's
don't think
my
we
point,
have.
Leslie.
No, but I don't think there ever are. But
isn't it the market?
I if think that's there's what been the, a lot of subsidies.
If millennials are looking for that, then the market's going to dictate that that's what the builders are going to build.
Well, you know, downtown LA is essentially what you're seeing is urban reuse, you know, where they're taking these old bank buildings and old office buildings and making them into condominiums. I mean, there's just a lot of really creative, wonderful things going on that don't really have anything to do with government or whatever. It just made sense for the developer to do that because the demand was there and you had these urban pioneers. And I think it's right. It's very exciting.
I think there is one development that gives more credibility to that than one might have looking sort of over history, and that's the development of charter schools. The fact that now the part of the flight to the suburbs was to get access to good quality schools, because a lot of the urban schools in many urban districts, not all, but in many, are not very healthy schools. So to the extent that the millennials would like a closer urban setting and they have access to charter schools, that I think has been some development. But if you match what they say is an aspiration to their actions, of those who have formed renting households, the majority are renting single-family homes. And that's what they're actually doing if you look at the American Community Survey. And so there's a statistical thing that you have to be careful of when you're looking at any group. If you go back 10 years, there were lots of predictions that the boomers liked to party. So when the kids moved out, they were going to sell their suburban homes and get a condo downtown and party the night away. Now, my wife and I live in Cape Coral, Florida, which our kids call God's waiting room. And I have to tell you, if you're going to get a reservation at a good restaurant in Cape Coral, wait till about 7:30. So what people saw was there were some boomers that were selling their suburban home and moving to the city, but there are so many of them that the number that were out in that behavioral tail was larger than their parents' population group. And so numerically you saw it happening, but proportionally there was not a behavioral change. So I think the same thing's going to apply to some degree with the millennials, because they are a larger population group than the boomers. So yes, some of them will do that. We don't know for sure whether it's going to be a behavioral change, but I think you kind of need to watch that characteristic. Okay. The fact that a number of them do it, that's important. But it may not reflect a behavioral change.
I just want to add one other thing with respect to affordability and baby boomers, and that is, I think, one of the key distinguishing characteristics of this cycle, at least from the perspective of my group, is lack of inventory. And I think that has to do with baby boomers who might want to sell and party downtown, but they're stuck. They can't afford to do it, right? Because even though their home has increased in value a lot, what they want to do is even more expensive. Plus, they might be giving up a great low-rate mortgage because, you know, they might be giving up a great tax base, particularly with Prop 13 in California. They have capital gains to worry about. They may not be able to qualify for a mortgage, the one they got 10 years ago. They're not going to be. So there's all kinds of reasons that have made listing inventory so sticky, you know, and I think people are stuck. And one of the portals did a survey of people asking, you know, how satisfied are you with your home? And you know what? Everybody loves being a homeowner, but you know, they want to tweak it. You know, they'd like to move, but they simply can't afford to do it. And I think that might be a structural impediment that's going to be with us for quite a while.
A futuristic question. I like going in limos with the group because I usually hear something. And 1 year, Sean was in there talking about 3D printers, and I honestly had never even heard of one. And he said he was buying his 10-year-old son one. I was like, okay. So I go home.
You printed the limo you were driving in, actually.
I go home and I pull it up, and then I sort of pay attention to it, and all of a sudden they're building a house with a 3D printer somewhere. So, you know, when I see that, is there any future in that becoming a competitor? You know, we get these little house shows where they've got this 80-square-foot house. I mean, how long would it take a 3D printer to whoop one of those up?
We are so overdue for technical innovation in the building industry.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate. Adrenaline Athletics, Coachella Valley Real Estate Investors Association, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Elite Auctions, iMortgage, In A Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, Kukan & Clark, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Lavis Tax Wealth Management, National RIA, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Orange County Phoebe, Real Wealth Network, Realty 411 Magazine, Resonant Lens Photography, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Sacramento Real Estate Club, Capital City Wealth Builders, Southern California Chapter of the Appraisal Institute, Sonoka Corporation, Spinnaker Loans, Tri-Counties Association of Realtors, UDirect IRA Services, Weston South Coast Plaza, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event video and sponsor information.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.